And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios, right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is November the 18th, 322nd day of the year. 43 days remain till the year's over with. I note with interest our purported vice president says things aren't going too well. And we've got the usual Democratic loudmouths saying, oh, you just don't understand. Things are so much better than you think they are. Why? Because we say they are. Well, in the year 326, the old St. Peter's Basilica is consecrated by Pope Sylvester. Yes, a man who says he is God's shepherd on earth waves his hand and something is consecrated. In the year 401, the Visigoths, led by King Alaric I, cross the Alps and invade northern Italy. That was the beginning of the end for Rome. 1095, the Council of Clermont begins. Called by Pope Urban II, it led to the First Crusade to the Holy Land. You people are a pain in the ass, so go over there and kill those folks. 1105, Agnenulfus, a person who, in opposition to the legitimately elected pope, makes an attempt to occupy the position of Bishop of Rome and a leader of the Catholic Church. And between the 3rd and mid-15th centuries, antipopes were supported by important factions within the church and by secular rulers. And sometimes it was difficult to even determine which of two claimants should be called pope and which antipope, as in the case of Pope Leo VIII and Pope Benedict V. People who merely claim to be pope and have few followers, such as the modern conclavist antipopes, are not classified with the historic antipopes. So you can call yourself Harry the Hairy Ape, for that matter. If folks support you, you got a chance. In 1180, Philip II becomes King of France. 1210, Pope Innocent III, and he was not innocent, let me assure you, excommunicate Holy Roman Emperor Otto IV. In 1282, Pope Martin IV excommunicates King Peter III of Aragon. In 1302, Pope Boniface VIII issues the papal bull Unum Sanctum, claiming spiritual supremacy for the papacy. I say it so, so it is so. 1421, a dike in the Groothollandse Waard in the Netherlands breaks. Floods 72 villages, kills about 10,000 people. This is known as St. Elizabeth's Flood. 1493, Christopher Columbus sights the island now known as Puerto Rico. 1494, French King Charles VIII occupies Florence, Italy. 1601, Teriyaki Hassan Pasha, an Ottoman provincial governor, routs the Habsburg forces commanded by Ferdinand, the Archduke of Austria, during the siege of Nicanza. 1626, the new St. Peter's Basilica is consecrated. 1730, the future Frederick the Great of Prussia is granted a pardon by his father and released from confinement. The 1760, the rebuilt debtor's prison at the Castellania in Valletta receives the first prisoners. 1803, the Battle of Vertaires, the last major battle of the Haitian Revolution is fought, leading to the establishment of the Republic of Haiti, the first black republic in the Western Hemisphere. In 1809, in a naval action during the Napoleonic Wars, French frigates defeat British East Indiamen in the Bay of Bengal. And that was unusual for the Brits to be defeated on the high seas. 1812, Napoleonic Wars, the Battle of Krasnoye ends in French defeat. But Marshal of France Michel Ney's leadership leads him to become known as the bravest of the brave. 1863, King Christian IX of Denmark signs the November Constitution that declares Schleswig to be part of Denmark. seen by the German Confederation as a violation of the London Protocol and leads to the German-Danish War of 1864. In 1872, Susan B. Anthony and 14 other women are arrested for voting illegally in the U.S. presidential election of 1872. 1883, American and Canadian Railroad Institutes, five standard continental time zones, ending the confusion of thousands of local times. 1901, Britain and the U.S. sign the Punxsutawney Treaty, which nullifies the Clayton-Buller Treaty and which draws British objections to an American-controlled canal in Panama. 1903, the Hay-Bonal Varilla Treaty signed by the U.S. and Panama, giving the U.S. exclusive rights over the Panama Canal Zone, that Jimmy, I'm wonderful, Carter, gave away. 1905, Prince Carl of Denmark becomes King Haakon VII of Norway. 1909, two U.S. warships are sent to Nicaragua after 500 revolutionaries, including two Americans, are executed by orders of Jose Santos Zelaya. 1910, in her campaign for women's voting rights, hundreds of suffragettes marched to the British Parliament in London. Several were beaten by the police. Newspaper attention embarrasses the authorities, and the march is dubbed Black Friday. And there was one hell of a sale after it was over. 1916, World War I. First Battle of the Somme. In France, the British Expeditionary Force commander Douglas Haig calls off the battle, which started July 1, 1916. 1918, Latvia declares its independence from Russia. 1928, release of the animated short Steamboat Willie, the first fully synchronized sound cartoon directed by Walt Disney and Ub Iwerks, featuring the third appearance of cartoon characters Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse. This is considered by the Disney Corporation to be Mickey's birthday. 1929, Grand Banks earthquake. Off the south coast of Newfoundland in the Atlantic Ocean, a Richter magnitude 7.2 submarine earthquake centered on the Grand Banks breaks 12 submarine transatlantic telegraph cables and triggers a tsunami that destroys many south coast communities in the Burin Peninsula. 1940, World War II, German leader Adolf Hitler and Italian foreign minister Galeazzo Ciano meet to discuss Benito Mussolini's disastrous Italian invasion of Greece. 1943, World War II, Battle of Berlin. 440 Royal Air Force planes bomb Berlin, causing only light damage and killing 131 people. RAF loses 9 aircraft and 53 aircrew. 1944, the popular socialist youth is founded in Cuba. 1947, Valentine's department store fire in Christchurch, New Zealand kills 41. It's the worst fire disaster in the history of New Zealand. 1949, the Iva Valley shooting occurs after the coal miners of Enugu in Nigeria go on strike over withheld wages. 21 miners are killed and 51 are wounded by police under the supervision of the British Colonial Administration of Nigeria. 1961, on this date, U.S. President John Kennedy sends 18,000 military advisors to South Vietnam. 1963, the first push-button telephone goes into service. 1970, President Nixon asks Congress for $155 million in supplementary aid for the Cambodian government. 1971, Oman declared its independence from the UK. 1978, McDonnell Douglas, FA-18 Hornet, makes its first flight at the Naval Air Test Center in Maryland. 1978, in Jonestown, Guyana, Jim Jones led his people's temple to a mass murder-suicide that claimed 918 lives in all, 909 of them in Jonestown itself, which included over 270 children. Congressman Leo Ryan is murdered by members of the People's Temple hours before the suicide takes place. 1987, King's Cross Fire. In London, 31 people dying of fire at the city's busiest underground station, King's Cross St. Pancras. 1988, the war on drugs. President Reagan signs a bill into law allowing the death penalty for drug traffickers. 1991, Shiite Muslim kidnappers in Lebanon release Anglican Church envoy Terry Waite and Thomas Sutherland. 1991, after an 87-day siege, the Croatian city of Vukovar capitulates to the besieging Yugoslav People's Army and allied Serb paramilitary forces. 1993, in the U.S., the North American Free Trade Agreement is approved by the House of Representatives. Basically, the attitude was, screw American business, we got to take care of Mexico. 1993, in South Africa, 21 political parties approve a new constitution, expanding voting rights and ending white minority rule. 1996, a fire occurs on a train traveling through the tunnel from France to England, causing several injuries and damaging approximately 1,600 feet of the tunnel. 1999, at Texas A&M, the Aggie bonfire collapses, kills 12 students, injures 27 others. 2002, Iraq disarmament crisis. United Nations weapons inspectors led by Heinz Blix arrive in Iraq. 2003, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court rules 4-3 in Goodrich versus Department of Public Health. The state's ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. They gave the state legislature 180 days to change the law, making Massachusetts the first state in the U.S. to grant marriage rights to same-sex couples. 2012, Pope Tewodros II of Alexandria becomes the 118th Pope of the Coptic Orthodox Church of Alexandria. 2013, NASA launches the MAVEN probe to Mars. 2020, the Utah monolith, built sometime in 2016, is discovered by state biologists of the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. For those that are not sure what the Utah monolith is, it's a metal pillar that stood in a red sandstone slot canyon in northern San Juan County, Utah. It's 9.8 feet tall, made of metal sheets riveted into a triangular prism. Unlawfully placed on public land between July and October 2016. Stood unnoticed for over 4 years till its discovery and removal in late 2020. The makers, as well as their objectives, are still unknown. Utah state biologists discovered the monolith in November 2020 during a helicopter survey of wild bighorn sheep. Within days of its discovery, members of the public found the pillar using GPS mapping software. It was covertly removed November 27, 2020 by four residents of Moab, Utah. After keeping it for a month, they gave it to the Bureau of Land Management. It's currently in custody of the government. Nobody has a clue how it got there. Alrighty, a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays observances. Christian Feast Day, Abhai of Hak in the Syriac Orthodox Church, Alphaeus and Zacharias, Barulus, Constant, Dedication of Saritas, Peter and Paul, I'm sorry, I can't read my own handwriting, Saints Peter and Paul, Elizabeth of Hungary in the Church of England, Jithwara, Mabon in the Roman Catholic Church and the Anglican Church, the main day of the Feast of the Virgin of the Chiquinquirá, or Chinita's Fair in Maracaibo, Venezuela. Moldez and Moez. Nazareus in Nazaire. Odo of Cluny. Romanus of Caesarea. Rose Philippine Duchesne. Day of Army and Navy. I'm sorry, Day of Army and Victory in Haiti. Independence Day in Morocco celebrates independence in Morocco from France and Spain in 1956. In Oman, it's National Day. Proclamation Day of the Republic of Latvia celebrates independence of Latvia from Russia in 1918. It's Remembrance Day of the Sacrifice of Vukovar in 1991 in Croatia. Alrighty, let's see what else we've got. 794, Japanese Emperor Kamu deallocates residents of Nara to Kyoto. Um, 1307, William Tell on this date reputedly shoots an apple off his son's head. 1421, Southern Sea flood 72 villages, killing about 10,000 people in the Netherlands. 1424, major storm flood ravages Dutch coast. 1477, the first English dated printed book, Tractes and Sciences of the Philosophers by William Caxton. Excuse me, 1497. Portuguese navigator Vasco da Gama reaches the Cape of Good Hope. 1667, the Treaty of Bungaja. King Hassan Udin of Makassar and the VOC. 1686, Charles Francois Felix operates on Henry XIV of France's anal fistula after practicing surgery on several peasants. 1738, France and Austria sign a peace treaty. 1745, Bonnie Prince Charlie, pretender to the British throne's troops, occupy Carlisle. 1755, the worst quake in Massachusetts Bay Area strikes Boston. There are no deaths reported. 1776, the Hessians capture Fort Lee, New Jersey. 1787, the first Unitarian minister in the U.S. is ordained in Boston. 1804, Pavarpuram I celebrated to commemorate a miraculous escape. 1805, 30 women meet at Miss Silas Lee's home in Wachusett, Maine, organized the Female Charitable Society, the first women's club in America. 1820, Antarctica sighted by U.S. Navy Captain Nathaniel Palmer. 1833, Netherlands and Belgium signed the Treaty of Zonhoven. 1837, the letter by Göttingen VII, published protesting the abolition of the Constitution of the Kingdom of Hanover. It was written by seven professors, including Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm. 1852, the state funeral of the Duke of Wellington in St. Paul's Cathedral in London. 1852, Rose Philippine Duchesne dies in St. Charles, Missouri. She'd be canonized on July 3rd, 1988 by Pope John Paul II. 1861, the first provisional meeting of the Confederate Congress is held in Richmond. 1865, on this date, Mark Twain publishes The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. 1874, the National Women's Christian Temperance Union is organized in Cleveland. 1889, the Oahu Railway begins public service in Hawaii. 1894, Richard Alcott's early comic strip, Origin of a New Species, published in the World. 1902, Brooklyn toy maker Morris Micton names the teddy bear after U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt. 1904, General Esteban Huerta steps down after the government of Panama fears he wants to stage a coup. 1906, anarchist bombs St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. 1909, U.S. invades Nicaragua, later overthrows President Zelaya. 1911, Britain's first seaplane takes to the air. 1912, cholera breaks out in Constantinople in the Ottoman Empire. 1913, Lincoln Nitsche becomes the first American pilot to perform an aircraft loop-de-loop in his Curtiss aeroplane. He did it right near San Diego. 1916, British General Douglas Haig calls off the first Battle of the Somme in World War I after more than 1 million soldiers had been killed or wounded. He was known for saying 5 miles of mud costs 1 million casualties. 1917, Sigma Alpha Rho, a Jewish high school fraternity, is founded in Philadelphia. 1918, Belgian troops re-enter Brussels, lost to the Germans on August 20th, 1914. 1922, the Turkish National Assembly nominates Abdul Majid Khalif. 1926, Pope Pius XI issued an encyclical on persecution of the church in Mexico. Pius XI was the 259th pope. 1936, Germany and Italy recognized the Spanish government of Francisco Franco, Spanish dictator. He later stepped down in favor of one of my relatives. 1939, the Dutch KNSM passenger ship Simon Bolivar hits a German mine. 86 die. 1939, the Irish Republican Army explodes 3 bombs in Piccadilly Circus. 1941, British troops open the attack on Tobruk in North Africa. 1941, Mussolini's forces leave Abyssinia, also known as Ethiopia. 1943, 444 British bombers attack Berlin. Also in 43, the U-211 sinks in the Atlantic Ocean. 1950, South Korean President Syngman Rhee is forced to end mass. He is the first president of South Korea. His enemies were dealt with in mass executions. He had to end them on this date in 1950. 1951, British troops occupy Ismailia in Egypt. 1951, former Cubs first baseman and future TV star rifleman Chuck Connors is the first player to oppose the Major League Draft. 1956, Morocco gained its independence on this date. Alrighty, we've come to the end of our history segment. You know, we've been talking about a lot of off-the-wall things. The last couple of shows have been about, are there others on the moon? Well, there's equal mysteries on the planet. For example, is it possible for a human being to literally walk off the earth in full view of witnesses? Well, it happened on a bright, sunny afternoon, September 23rd, 1980. It was the farm of David Lang, a few miles from Gallatin, Tennessee. Been there quite often. Now, it was very pleasing surroundings. His home was a rambling brick house, almost covered in vines. Right in front of it was a 40-acre pasture, which had short grass. Cattle grazed on it, don't you know? And it had been a long, dry spell in the summer, so the grass was starting to turn brown. On that particular afternoon, his two children, George, 8, and his daughter, Sarah, who was 11, were playing with a new wooden wagon pulled by wooden horses. Their father had got it for him in Nashville that very morning. And they were pulling the toy around in the front yard as their mother and father came out of the house. Well, Mr. Lang was going out to see his horses, of which he was proud. And his wife said to him, hurry back, I want you to drive me into town before the stores close. He stopped at the fence to look at his pocket watch. He said, I'll be back in a few minutes. But he never came back. 30 seconds later, something happened. The youngster spotted a horse and buggy coming up the lane toward the house and stopped their play to watch it. They noticed it was the buggy belonging to Judge August Peck, who always had presents for him. And Mrs. Lang saw the carriage, as did David Lang. He waved at the judge and turned to come back to the house. He had taken not more than a half a dozen steps when he just literally vanished. The children, too, started to realize what had happened, just stood, and everybody ran toward the spot where their father had been just seen just a few seconds before. Judge Peck and his companion, the judge's brother-in-law, scrambled out of the buggy and raced toward the field. Five of them got to the spot of Lang's disappearance almost simultaneously. There wasn't a tree, a bush, nor even a hole to mar the surface of the ground. There wasn't a single clue to indicate what might have happened to him. Well, the grown-ups searched the field around and around and found nothing. Ms. Lang became hysterical and had to be led into the house. Neighbors had been alerted by the frantic ringing of the huge bell that stood in the side yard, and they arrived and spread the alarm. By nightfall, the scores of people were on the scene. Many of them had lanterns, and they searched every foot of that field in which he'd last been seen. They stamped their feet on the ground and hoped to detect some hole that he might have fallen into, but they didn't find anything. David Lang had vanished, in full view of his wife, two children, and two men in the buggy. One second he was there, walking across the sunlit field, next second he was gone. In the weeks that followed, the authorities had to take steps to keep the curiosity seekers away from the farm. Ms. Lang was bedridden from shock of the experience, and all the servants, left with the exception of the old family cook, whose name was Suki, and thanks to Judge Peck, some measure of peace and quiet was restored. Subsequent examination of the witnesses disclosed that all seen the same thing at the same time and in the same place. County surveyor showed up and probed the field where it vanished and found it solidly supported by a thick layer of limestone. No sinkholes, no caves. Well, there wasn't even a funeral or a memorial service for Mr. Lang. His wife, who lived many years after the event, clung to the hope somehow, some way, he might come back. Eventually, she let Judge Peck rent out the farm, with the exception of the field in front of the house. As long as she lived, that particular field stayed untouched. With the passage of time, the excitement which followed the remarkable disappearance of David Lang subsided. Winter came, spring came. Ms. Lang sold her horses. Judge Peck put his own horses in the field. And as strange as the disappearance itself was, the experience that happened to the two children, one still warm evening in April of 1881, about 7 months after the father disappeared. Children noticed that at the spot where he had last been seen, there was a circle of stunted yellow grass, about 15 feet in diameter. On that particular evening, as they stood beside the circle, 11-year-old Sarah called out to her father. And to everybody's astonishment, he answered, calling faintly for help, over and over. And then eventually the voice faded away. No one ever determined what happened to David Lang. You know, sometimes those that we in our belief that we're superior look at as superstitious natives know more than we think they do. And sneering at natives' tales of incredible monsters really isn't wise. Because sometimes the natives do know what they're talking about. Well, this was demonstrated in the latter half of the 19th century when an American explorer, Paul de Richelieu, brought home the skin and skeleton of a giant gorilla. It confounded his skeptics. Now, thus far, nobody had brought in hide nor hair of the abominable snowman of the Himalayas, but there were scientists who think this is going to happen. The natives who live in that stark, forbidding region call these creatures Yeti, which has been translated into abominable. But that isn't the real meaning of the word. But it's the nearest thing we can use for general distribution in mixed company. The Yeti, or the abominable snowman, according to the natives, live high up in the craggy fastness of the Himalayas. That's an area that nobody really wants. But the trouble is, they come down to the valleys where the natives live on occasion, and according to the stories told by the Sherpas, the Yetis don't confine themselves to eating frogs from the valley ponds and the tender shoots from the trees and the rice patches. They also indulge themselves in a craving for fresh meat. Sometimes they steal a goat, sometimes they steal a pet yak, and sometimes they make off with a child or an isolated herdsman who made the fatal error of sleeping in the sun. Well, as the British occupation of India spread to the foothills of the Himalayas, they encountered their first reports of these strange creatures and dismissed them as figments of overwrought native imagination. The first tiny crack in the wall of doubt came in 1913 when a group of Chinese hunters wounded and captured a strange man-like creature that the Tibetans called a snowman. Chinese said it was kept captive at Patang in Sanking province for months. It was a creature with a black monkey-like face covered with silvery yellow hair, inches long, had exceptionally powerful hands, and had feet much like those of a human, rather than like an ape. It grunted, made gruntled sounds, and spent most of its time pursing its lips and making loud whistling noises. After 5 months in captivity, it sickened and died. Well, the outbreak of World War I stifled any scientific ventures into that area. In 1937, a British explorer named Frank Smith came out of Tibet with reports of man-like wild creatures of an unknown type that frequented the upper reaches of the Himalayas. He said they lived on grubs and rodents and on larger animals when they could get them. Smith had found their tracks at the 14,000-foot level. The Sherpa guide took one look and refused to go any further. Well, measurements of the prints showed they were remarkably human in shape, but the stride was such that one foot imprinted its toes on the heel of the other. The size was about 13 inches long by 5 inches wide. That's a good-sized foot, I don't care who you are. Since that time, a lot of expeditions have reported finding evidence that the abominable snowman is a living creature that may someday be brought into camp. Well, some have seen no more than a British major named Alan Cameron, who was with the Everest expedition in 1923. He and his party were working their way toward the peak of Everest, and one of the guides spotted a line of living creatures moving slowly along a cliff face well above the snow line. 2 days later, when Cameron's group reached a point near that cliff face, they found giant man-like footprints in the snow. In late 1936, the first ship and expedition to Everest encountered more of the strange tracks where there should have been no tracks. Hello. Same as I've had the last 30 times, I've asked y'all not to call me. Well, unfortunately, and the health advisors, as they call themselves, are falling over themselves trying to sell anybody and everybody health insurance. Well, we were talking about British Major Alan Cameron. Late 1936, as I said, the first Shipton expedition to Everest encountered more of these tracks where there should have been no tracks. Around the fringes of the snow line on the bleak slopes of the approaches to Everest, H.W. Tillman, a member of the Shipton expedition who followed the tracks for several miles, noted they ran one behind the other in a manner no four-footed creature uses. Tillman finally lost them in a long stretch of barren rock. 1958, an American scientist named Dr. Norman Dierenforth reported from Kathmandu, Nepal, he'd found evidence that convinced him the abominable snowman was in reality a very low grade of human or near-human creature. By seeking out caves in which they lived without fire, he collected hair, both silver gray and reddish-brown, food scraps, plaster cast of footprints, and other odds and ends to show the elusive snowman are actually real. Yet there are two species, the large one about 8 feet tall at maturity and the other one about 4 feet tall. 1958, an anthropologist at Johns Hopkins, who, of course, did not leave his ivory tower and air conditioning, declared the abominable snowman footprints were prints made by natives whose toes stuck through their worn-out sandals, to which the Chicago Tribune replied, "It's a good explanation for one who's never been there, and who lives far enough away to be disinterested," and that's quite true. Well, let's talk about a neglected genius. Years before Marconi won fame for sending and receiving wireless code signals, a Kentucky farmer had been publicly sending and receiving both voice and music by wireless. And his success is no stranger than the oblivion that befell him. Now, the crowd that milled around on the courthouse lawn in Murray, Kentucky, on that day in 1892 had no concept of the historic nature of the occasion. They'd come by the hundreds to scoff at the efforts of an eccentric fellow farmer named Nathan Stubblefield, who claimed he could send messages through the air without wires. Even when he performed the feat before their own eyes, they failed to appreciate the magnitude of that event. At points between about 200 feet apart on the courthouse lawn, Stubblefield set up two boxes, each one about 2 feet square, not connected in any way. Each box contained a telephone, and as Stubblefield and his son talked to one another from opposite sides of the courthouse lawn, their voices could be heard clearly by the curious crowd that clustered around the boxes. When the historic experiment was concluded, Stubblefield was greeted by hoots and snickers. So he took his equipment, tossed it into his wagon, condemned himself for his stupidity in conducting his demonstration among idiots. It's 1892. Marconi had later to become famous as the father wireless of then this 18-year-old boy. Nathan Stubblefield, telephone fixer, had eked out an existence on a flinty farm in Callaway County, Kentucky, had conducted a public demonstration of wireless transmission of the human voice for the first time in known history. He had been laughed out of town for his achievement. Word of what he'd done finally got to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which wrote to him asking for a demonstration. Weeks later, the paper got acknowledgement of their request. A postcard, it just said, "Have accepted your invitation. Come to my place anytime, Nathan Stubblefield." Well, the reporter for the Post-Dispatch arrived at Stubblefield's farm January 10, 1902. The inventor handed him a telephone which was connected to a pair of steel rods about 4 feet long, told him to take the outfit anywhere he liked in the neighborhood, put the rods into the ground, and put the receiver to his ear. In recounting his experience in a newspaper article, the reporter told how he'd gone about a mile from the inventor's house, put the rods into the ground, and as he said, "I could hear every syllable the Stubblefield boy spoke into a transmitter as clearly as if he was across the room." So how'd he do it? Well, Stubblefield told the newsman that he was merely using the electrical field that permeated the earth, the water, and the atmosphere. He predicted that someday wireless transmission of speech would enable people living in Kentucky to listen to weather reports from the nation's capital, hear music and news from points all over the world. Now, I will point out that when I was much younger, somebody gave me a radio, transistor radio. Didn't have any power. You had two clips on it, and you hooked them to anything metal that basically grounded them, and it would act just like it had a battery in it. Newspaper article brought invitations for this Kentucky telephone repairman and part-time farmer to bring his gear to Philadelphia for demonstrations before interested financiers. And he scored a spectacular success there in May of 1902. Then he went to D.C., where he again amazed scientists of his time by the magic of his abilities. Of course, as usual, there were skeptics on hand to see him fail. Preposterous to think this untutored fellow from Kentucky Hills could send and receive voice messages when Marconi himself could only send and receive dots and dash code. Well, the gear was installed in a little steamship, Bartholdi, and scores of prominent people stationed themselves at points of their own choosing along the Virginia shore of the Potomac. And as the ship churned the waters, the startled dignitaries communicated with those on board the ship, clearly and distinctly, by merely sticking the iron rods in the ground and speaking into their telephones. Washington Evening Star said in headlines on May 21, 1902, the first practical test of wireless telegraphy heard for a half mile. It's an invention of a Kentucky farmer. Well, plaudits ringing in his ears, financiers, and begged him for contracts to enable them to develop the invention. But he packed up his stuff and went home. He was afraid somebody would steal his ideas. He took out patents, and they make little sense to those who studied them. As time dragged by, and others learned to send in messages just as he had done years before, Stubblefield became increasingly bitter and morose. He was found dead in his shack in the spring of 1929. His equipment was missing. His records were scattered. There's a stone memorial on the courthouse lawn in Murray, Kentucky, that marks the spot where he made history in 1892. He'd foreseen with surprising accuracy the wonders that broadcasting could accomplish. And he also said himself he'd live 50 years before his time. Well, from mysterious inventions, let's talk about, is it possible for a man to be swallowed by a whale and live to tell the story? Well, I retired scientists say no. But the correct answer is yes. The official records of the British Admiralty provide documentary evidence for the astounding account of James Bartley, a British seaman who was swallowed by a whale and lived to tell about it. He was making his first and only trip as a sailor aboard the whaling ship Star of the East. February of 1891, she was pounding along before a fair wind a few hundred miles east of the Falkland Islands in the South Atlantic. Suddenly the lookout gave his cry, "There she blows!" He had sighted a huge sperm whale half a mile off the port bow. Star of the East slackened her sails, and the whaling crew scrambled into their boats and went off to harpoon this mighty mammal, if possible. Young James Bartley was in the first longboat to reach the side of the whale. Pulling slowly on their oars, the sailors drove their frail cockle shell behind the unsuspecting creature, so near the harpooner could lean over and drive his huge spear deep into the whale's vitals. Then Bartley and his fellow seamen back frantically to get out of the reach of those massive tail flukes that thrashed the water to foam as the stricken beast fought to free itself from the barbed harpoon. And for a moment, the sailors seemed to be having some luck. The whale plunged deep into the ocean, and 800 feet of heavy line streaked out of the tub before the creature ceased to dive. Well, then there was a slackening of the line because the creature was coming up. But where was it coming? In such cases, this was a matter of life and death, and the sailors didn't have long to wait for the answer. They were hunched over their oars, ready to pull for their lives once they knew which way to pull. And without warning, the sea boiled up around them. There was a splintering crash as their boat spun into the air. And the mortally wounded whale thrashed about madly in its agony, beating the water to a bloody froth before he sounded at the depths again. Nearby longboat picked up the survivors. But two men were missing. One was apprentice sailor, James Bartley. The wind that had borne the Star of the East to the scene of this tragedy now deserted her, and she walked in long swells, her sails flapping. Short before sunset, the dying whale floated to the surface for about 400 yards from the vessel. Crew hastily fastened a line to the whale, and the winch brought it slowly to the ship. Hot weather made it imperative it be cut up at once. Since they had no means of raising the 100-ton mammal to the deck, they took flensing spades and peeled off the thick blubber as they slipped and slid along the creature's back. It was dirty work and it was dangerous because the water was full of sharks, maddened by the taste of blood. Just before 11 that night, working by lantern light, the tired crewman removed the stomach and the huge liver and hoisted them aboard ship for processing. Well, there on the deck of the ship, they were startled to notice movement inside the giant stomach, the slow, rhythmic movement that looked like something breathing. The captain called the ship's doctor, and a great incision was made in the tough flesh.
Human foot became visible, shoe and all. Moment later, they'd pulled out one of the missing sailors, James Bartley, doubled up, unconscious, but still alive. Maybe for the want of anything better, the excited doctor ordered Bartley drenched with buckets of salt water. This treatment soon restored consciousness, but not his reason. He was babbling incoherently as thrashed about in his delirium. For almost 2 weeks, he lingered between life and death, strapped to the bunk in the captain's cabin. Gradually, so the ship's doctor wrote in a record that was signed off of by everybody on board, he got his senses back. But it was a month before he could tell them what had happened. He remembered being flung into the air when the whale crushed their longboat, and as he fell back into the sea, he saw that tremendous mouth open over it. Well, he screamed as he was engulfed. Sharp, stabbing pains as he was swept across the rows of tiny, sharp teeth. Then he found himself sliding down a slimy tube. He recalled fighting for his breath, kicking about, and then he was unconscious. Till he regained consciousness a month later in the captain's cabin. He'd been inside the ship's stomach, the whale's stomach, for 15 hours. And as a result, lost all the hair on his body. His skin was bleached to an unnatural whiteness, and he was almost blind for the rest of his life. He spent his remaining years as a shoe cobbler in his native Gloucester. Numerous medical men from many lands came to examine him and to discuss his incredible experience. He lived for another 18 years, and on his tombstone is a brief account of his experience and a footnote that says, James Bartley, modern Jonah. Well, you know, sometimes, usually on the point of death, people come up with what you might call famous last words. Let's talk about Archimedes. A Roman soldier brandished his short two-handed sword menacingly around the head of the old man seated on the floor. Archimedes, one of the greatest of early Greek scholars, never bothered to look up at the warrior. The soldier ordered the old man to get up and follow him, and Archimedes said, "No, not until I finish my problem." Well, a few moments later, the sword in the hands of a nameless soldier brought an end to the career of one of the greatest thinkers of all times. How about Henry Ward Beecher, stormy and controversial pulpit figure of the 19th century? He'd preached to millions during his lifetime. He'd counseled them to be ready for the grim reaper, and he had pictured them for them what lay beyond the grave. And as Beecher himself lay gasping out his last breath, he pulled the physician down to him and whispered in his ear, "Doctor, now comes the mystery." How about Anne Boleyn, consort of the king, now ready to pay with her life her involvement with royalty? She was calm to the last. Turning to a companion who was trembling violently, she said, "Take courage. The executioner is an expert in many years' training, and my neck is very slender." Certainly an understatement. Outside the bedchamber, Queen Elizabeth, scores of people knelt to pray for her. The queen, attended by the finest physicians of the time, was struggling to the last. And as the pale horseman drew nearer and nearer, she could no longer deny the inevitable was coming. Shaking a clenched fist at her own impotence, she said, "All my possessions for one moment of time." How about Cardinal Wolsey? Like many another who aspired to greatness, became entangled in the political toils of his time and paid for it with his life. As he faced the executioner, he said, "Had I but served my God with half the zeal that I served my king, he wouldn't have left me in my gray hairs." How about William Porter, known to millions for his delightful short stories written in the name of O. Henry? He was ill for a long time before he realized the end was near. He clenched the hand of a close friend and sat beside the bed. For a long moment, there was no sound except his labored breathing. And then he looked at his friend and said, "Charlie, I'm afraid to go home in the dark." Well, as Sir Thomas More was being led to the scaffold blindfolded, he asked the bandage be removed, and to his jailer he remarked, "See me safely up to the gibbet, sir. On the downward voyage, let me shift for myself." How about John Barrymore? He was another whose sense of humor was with him to the last. He'd been unconscious near death for hours when he suddenly regained consciousness. With his last bit of strength, he grinned at his friend, Gene Fowler, and said, "Tell me, Gene, are you really the illegitimate son of Buffalo Bill?" How about Dr. Samuel Garth, famous physician who had made a fortune ministering to the ailments of Renaissance royalty, had one last request to make of fellow physicians who gathered around his bedside. "Please, gentlemen, step back and let me die a natural death." And Hobbes, consultant the great near great of his day, said, "I now go to take my last voyage, a leap to the, in the dark." Well, the Countess of Rouen was famed for her impeccable manners. As the end for her drew near, a servant tiptoed into the room and announced that a visitor wished to see the Countess. Courteous lady had the servant write a card that said, "The Countess of Rouen sends her compliments, but begs to be excused. She's engaged in dying." How about James Smithson, founder of the world-famous Smithsonian Institution in Washington? He was a very unusual man in many ways, and he had a knack for humor that was with him to the last. His fatal illness was one that the doctors had not been able to diagnose. When he realized that little time was left, he called his physician to him and said, "I want you to perform an autopsy to discover what's wrong with me. I'm dying for you to find out what's wrong." Well, Thomas Edison had a last remark that left a puzzle of the family. The great inventor wasn't an atheist, as some have claimed, nor did he do. Neither did he discuss his beliefs, whatever they might have been, with those nearest to him. As he lay dying, slowly and painfully, his wife held his hand, seemed to be asleep. Other than the labored beating of his heart, the room was perfectly quiet. Suddenly, Mr. Edison sat up in bed without any assistance, opened his eyes, stared straight ahead for several seconds, turned to his wife and said, "I'm surprised. It's very beautiful over there." Then he died. So ask yourself, what did he see? Mr. Edison couldn't say, and no man can tell us. Well, you know, I've talked many times about mysterious disappearances, but how about an entire village? There's something creepy about the appearance of the little Eskimo village that lay in front of the man, and Trapper Joe LaBelle sensed as he paused to survey the scene. The icy wind that blew off Lake Anjikuni flapped the skins that hung over the gaping doors of the huts. There were a few battered kayaks blown up on the beach. No dogs barked. Not a single voice broke the silence. So Joe LaBelle asked himself the logical question, where are the people? And that was a good question on this particular November day in 1930. And there's not been an answer to this day. For many years, Joe had known this friendly little Eskimo village 500 miles north of the Mounties base at Churchill. And on this particular day, he'd gone miles out of his way across the frozen tundra to spend a few hours with his friends. And he'd be greeted by an ominous silence. According to his report to the Northwest Mounted Police, he stopped at the edge of the village and yelled a greeting. Got no reply of any kind. A most unusual approach to this friendly little community. He opened the caribou skin flap to one of the huts and called out again. He was greeted by silence. Similar experience awaited him at every hut in the village. He found it all very spooky, for there was no one else to whom he could say it. Certainly spooky. And so it remains. He spent about an hour in the village examining it for some hint as to what might have happened to the missing people. Found pots of food hanging untouched over fires that had been cold for months. One hut, there were some sealskin garments for a small child. The ivory needle still stuck in the garment where the mother had abruptly ceased her mending. On the beach were three kayaks, including the one that he knew belonged to the headman of the village. These flimsy craft had been battered and torn by the wave action on the beach. Certainly evidence had been there for quite a long time. Joe LaBelle and the Mounties were who investigated after his report found the most puzzling bits of evidence when they looked into the empty huts and tents. There were the Eskimos' prized rifles standing forlornly inside the doors, waiting for masters who never returned. Now, in the far north, the rifle is more than a valued possession. It's virtually a life insurance policy. No Eskimo in his right mind would go on a trip without his rifle. But here were the guns, and the Eskimos were gone. How about the dogs? The big, powerful brutes that are almost as important as that bleak land as the Rifles. About 100 yards from the camp, LaBelle and the Mounties found 7 dogs that had been tied to the stumps of some scrubby trees, and all had died of starvation, as a Canadian pathologist later confirmed. But the most baffling aspect of the entire enigma was found on the side of the camp opposite the bodies of the dogs. There, the Eskimos had buried some member of their tribe under the customary cairn of stones, but this grave had been opened, the body taken, and the stones stacked in 2 neat piles. Well, to Eskimos, grave robbing was unthinkable, and animals couldn't have stacked the stones so carefully. The experts summoned by the Mounties spent 2 weeks examining every bit of evidence they could find in a deserted village. They came to the conclusion that the Eskimos had not been there for about 2 months when Joe LaBelle arrived. That decision was based on the type of berries found in some of the cooking pots. Evidently, the village of about 30 people had been pursuing its normal way of life when for some reason they all rushed out of their huts and none of them ever got back from wherever they had gone. For reasons unknown, the inhabitants of the village, men, women, and children, had left it, willingly otherwise, in the dead of winter. They left so hurriedly they'd abandoned their food on the fires, their prize guns, their dogs, their clothing. Skilled trackers failed to find any trail if they had fled over the tundra. The presence of their battered kayaks were mute evidence they hadn't ventured out into the lake. And the plundered grave was just another bit of unexplained mystery. Months of patient and far-flung investigation failed to produce a single trace of any member who lived in the deserted village of Anjikuni. Mounted police filed it as unsolved, and it remains unsolved to this day. Well, what do you think about living creatures embedded in solid stone? Ivory Tower scientists say it can happen, but evidence indicates that it does, and more frequently than most people are aware. Let's go to April 22nd, 1881. Joe Molino was at the 60-foot level of the Wide West Mine near Ruby Hill, Nevada. Drove his pick under the jagged bit of stone that protruded from the side of the tunnel and pulled it loose. Stone fell. It struck him on the foot, and that infuriated him so much he grabbed a sledge and smashed the rock to smithereens. And he was astounded to see a cavity about the size of his fist exposed by the hammer blow. A cavity in the rock is filled with white worms of some sort. Joe picked them up, and they showed no signs of life at first, but after about a half hour, they began to move. And within an hour, as the half dozen miners watched in amazement, the worms were crawling slowly around on the floor of the tunnel. Well, the mine operators took charge of the worms and the stone and sent them to the U.S. Bureau of Mines and got a letter some weeks later informing them it was all a misunderstanding. It couldn't have happened because worms don't live in rocks. Fully as inexplicable was the case of the dull, reddish-gray beetle found embedded in a tight-fitting mold of iron ore taken from the Fane Longfellow mine near Clifton, Arizona. That was in 1892. When the lump of ore broke and the beetle was discovered in its iron sarcophagus, the samples turned over to a geologist in El Paso by the name of Z.T. White, probably Zach White. He placed it on a piece of paper in a specimen case that stood in his library, and about a week after the thing had been removed from the mine, he saw it move. Examining it under a magnifying glass, he saw a small beetle slowly emerge from the body of the specimen. Witnesses were summoned. The young beetle was placed in a jar where it lived for several months. Eventually, the ore and the beetle encased in it and the young beetle, which had emerged, were turned over to the Smithsonian in Washington, which could only join the others in bewilderment at the evidence. Well, we're going to talk more about things that are stranger than science, but at the moment, we've run out of time. So until tomorrow at this time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.